Blog Talk Radio.
And I'm your host, Paul Gant, alongside Jeremy Espy. And for the next 2 hours, we will be talking sports and having fun doing it. I want all your ideas, all your opinions, and all your beliefs. And, of course, you will get a heavy dose of our opinion. If you have an opinion, the number is to call 646-727-3070. That's 646-727-3070. And you can listen to the show at blogtalkradio.com/pgant. That's blogtalkradio.com/pgant. You can send email messages to the show at goforward.gant@gmail.com. That's goforward.gant@gmail.com. And make sure you follow the show on Twitter at goforward.gant. Jam-packed show today. Expect to be joined by Houston, Texas defensive end Jarvis Green. Expected to be joined by Ashley Walker from Basketball Wives, the girlfriend of Rafer Alston. And also former NFL player Darnarian McCann. He will stop by and he will talk about life after football. And we'll conclude with super agent Lee Steinberg, who represented guys like Ben Roethlisberger, Troy Aikman, and Steve Young. Jeremy, how are you today?
What's going on, baby?
How are things? Not too much.
Tax time, baby. Things are great.
For you, I would assume. For others, maybe. Maybe not so much. I mean, Uncle Sam is not everybody's friend.
That's a shame.
It sounds like he's your friend.
He should be.
It sounds like he's your friend, one of your better friends, I would assume, judging by what you just said. And as of right now, we're going to talk about this with Jarvis Green and also Lee Steinberg. The whole situation with this labor agreement, talks are not going well at this point. If you look at things, they went through federal mediation, really not paying much dividends according to reports, and it's looking more and more like there will be a lockout. And then the reality of it is if there's a lockout, fine, but if there's games missed, then you're talking about a bigger situation and a bigger problem. And it's looking more and more. You never know. These things happen in 11th hour. Things get done. Things get taken care of. But it's looking more and more like there will be a lockout in the 2011 season. Now, what gets missed, who knows, could be a lot of the OTA and a lot of the minicamps could get missed. I mean, we don't know at this point. But in my mind and in my opinion, this is a battle against billionaires, against millionaires, and haves against haves. And in this economy, people are not really going to be sympathetic to a battle of haves versus haves. I mean, people really are not going to be sympathetic to that whole situation. And the reality of it is the NFL is printing money. It's printing money, I mean, annually, $9 billion from television, from all different types of sources. I mean, NFL is making big-time money, big-time money. It's rating very high, and everything is going well. So in my mind, what is wrong with this system? I mean, profits are up. 19 of the 32, and this is according to Forbes magazine, 19 of the 32 teams are worth $1 billion. In this economy, in this horrible economy, the NFL is finding a way to profit and make money. I mean, why do we need to change?
Well, but Paul, you bring up it. I mean, one of the even more interesting points is when you compare, you know, the two biggest leagues, the NFL and the NBA. And I mean, the NBA has pretty much said they absolutely positively, with this new collective bargaining agreement that they're seeking, I mean, they really need to rein in salaries, put a hard cap in there because the ownership in those leagues, while there's value for the team, may have a net, you know, a value, a worth. I mean, the league as a whole has taken tremendous losses. But as you said, when you look at the NFL, I mean, teams are making money. The value of the clubs continue to rise. And the interesting thing is, it gets back to what you said. It's the haves and the haves. I mean, the players are making very good money. Veterans say, you know, that they want more of the lion's share than a young rookie. But I mean, look at Michael Vick. I mean, a one-year contract is going to net him, what, Paul, $18, $20 million? I mean, you're in that league, if you can establish yourself, it's really a can't-lose league.
And I guess in terms of, I mean, maybe more could be done for retired players. And also, I mean, a rookie wage scale, that's a problem. I mean, that needs to be changed. I mean, you look at Sam Bradford guaranteed $50 million and he hasn't even taken, before he even took a snap in the league. So that is something that probably needs to be looked at. But as a whole, the system in my mind has worked. I mean, if it's if you're making profits, it's working. If 19 of your 32 teams are worth over $1 billion, it's working. So in my mind, the system is working. Why change? And it comes down to what that they're $1 billion apart. And that, I mean, I guess that's a lot of money. But, I mean, right now the players, as it's presently constructed, right now I believe the split is 53 to 47. 53% of the money is going to the players, 47 to the owners. And the owners want that flip-flopped. So where it's 55% owners and 45% players. And in some respect, you can kind of understand that because the owners are the ones who are responsible, who are taking a risk financially. But at the same time, the players are the ones who draw people to the game. So it's something they're going to have to hash out here, and looking like it may not be hashed out anytime soon. But again, with negotiations, sometimes in that 11th hour, things get done. And as of right now, it's not looking good. It's not looking good. I mean, federal mediation was supposed to make this thing a little better, but apparently the two sides just cannot come to an agreement at this point. And it's looking like more and more that after March 3rd, when this CBA expires, there will be a lockout in. Reports are agents are getting prepared, coaches are getting prepared, and right now, if you're a player, you may have to get prepared for the possible lockout that may be on the horizon, and it's looking like it will be on the horizon.
But Paul, you know, keep in mind, I mean this. Don't underestimate the power of business. Especially from a guy who certainly enjoys tax season. Keep in mind, the haves and the has, as you call them, certainly are aware of what's at stake here. And you know, history does show leagues that do lock out players, and this is never, even though it is a have and a have battle, the ownership groups are really the ones that unfortunately take the brunt of this. And not to mention, I mean, this has been talked about for over a year on ESPN and the like. So no one really here needs to see this. And certainly no one wants this to, you know, to be on the news. The ownership group, I mean, they have been told time and again, I'm sure, by probably anyone and everyone that's willing to listen, this is really not this is not what we need right now. So there's still time. I mean, we're getting down to the 11th hour. But certainly, you know, I'm sure they can, and there's talks that, you know, potentially just even getting in and some meetings and look at, they're far apart, but I believe deals can be done in 20 minutes. If everyone at the table realizes what's at stake, things can change overnight.
And definitely, I agree with that. Let's bring in Houston Texans defensive end Jarvis Green. Jarvis, how are you, sir?
Hey, what's going on, guys? How y'all doing?
Not too bad.
How are you, man?
And Jarvis, I want to start on the field with you now. I mean, you signed with Denver in the offseason. That situation didn't work out for you. You had a workout late in the season with the Browns, but ultimately you signed with the Houston Texans late in the season. What was kind of your thinking in signing with the Texans?
Well, I'll tell you this, guys. I had two workouts with the Browns. So
okay.
I didn't understand that part. But signing with Houston, they call, and it's funny because they call like week two of the around the second week of the season, they called, and it was very serious about bringing me up, but, you know, it didn't happen until around week 12, week 13. So being a part of the Texans and also for myself, I know I live in Denver right now, but being close to home, that was great. You know, Houston being a great city, you know, to be in, and also with the Texans, I mean, as a team that, I mean, they have so much, upside to them. And just going to them and getting with them and trying to hopefully just bond. And hopefully, you know, my biggest thing is just being there once the season starts again, you know, for next year.
And Jarvis, and one of the reasons you were cut by Denver was because you were on the show previously. You talked about the knee injury that you had. At what point in the 2010 season were you at 100%?
Well, I mean, like I said, after I got released, I came back, and I was here still with Denver because my wife is in school. And just working out and just getting better and getting healthier, you know. And I could have played. I mean, I could have played the next week, but it just, I know the things we talked about with Denver and resting and me being. I mean, I'm not a guy that played 12 years, but being an old dog and played the games and played the refs and from what I did in New England, it was pretty much, you know, that was Josh. Coach Josh told me about doing in Denver, you know, giving me some time off because, you know, we play the game. It's a physical sport. But believe it or not, I don't know if the people outside of the game knows this, but guys, coaches do give guys a bone, you know, take days off and give them rest. And it's just like anything else in the business where, you know, a promise was made to me to say, hey, this is what's going to happen when you come here because you played the game, you know how to play the game, and get some rest in training camp and be ready for the season. But that didn't happen.
So, Jarvis, you touched on an interesting point about, you know, some of the fans certainly don't, I think, understand sometimes the complexities of these injuries, and they see some players coming back quicker and someone like yourself who may have sat out a year. How difficult are these knee injuries to come back from?
You know what, it is they're all hard. I mean, they're different ways. There's a different chemistry depending on what's wrong with that individual. But at the same time, when you're a guy that played the game, and you played your years, and you put your time in, you know, you get favors, you know, just like anything else in the real world. You know, you work 20 years at a job, you have favors. You have better, I guess, what's the word, fruits, things that's given to you. And the same thing with football. I mean, you know, it's a demanding sport. It's very physical. But if you come in as a rookie, second-year guy, you know, and you don't – and it's weird because people are we all have, I guess, we have like if I'm saying it right, but a notch for like a first-round pick to a guy that's fourth, fifth-round pick, he got to work twice as hard to come in and to perform on the field, you know. So he will get less favors compared to that first-round pick guy or that high draft pick guy or that guy that played, you know, in the league, you know, five, six, seven, eight-plus years compared to the guy that played first, second year. So my situation – you know, and other guys in the league, I mean, they get their days off, they get their rest, you know, that's the way the league is. You got to earn your spot, you know?
Right.
It's interesting. Let me pick up on this, Paul, for one second, because that's a really interesting point in that, especially for a guy, as you say, you know, fourth round, fifth round, first of all, to get on the field because of the money that's paid to the first and second round draft picks, it's tough. But then you know, to stay on the field, the amount of practice time, you know, the training camps, the workouts that the third, fourth, fifth, sixth round players to get on the field. So their body essentially, even if, you know, they come in and maybe a first year player to get on the field like second year, they take way more of a beating than a first year player who was, you know, anointed a starter.
Yes. That is very serious. I mean, that's the way the game is. I mean, I think most sports is like that. And because I can remember myself, and I could say that because I was a fourth-round pick. I remember busting my tail day in, day out, you know, and I'm a guy that played behind Richard Seymour, I think going to my second season in the NFL, you know, but I earned my keep, you know. I bust my tail, I was working out, I was practicing, I was making plays, and that's why, you know. So it's funny because you hear a lot of young guys talk, you know, and then they sit there and they have an injury and then they go, you hear them complaining about the training room staff and this and that. I'm like, hey, bro, you got to go play ball, man. You got to be on the field a lot more than you in the training room. If you want to make any club, you know, compared to a first-round pick guy, I mean, they're paying all that money. That's the initial investment. They can't just let that go to the wayside. You know, I mean, it's an investment for the team.
Right. And Jarvis, speaking of a guy who bounced around, your cousin, Green Bay Packers defensive tackle Howard Green, a guy who also appeared on the show, he made a big play in Super Bowl 45, and ultimately the Green Bay Packers would win the Super Bowl. But did you have any advice for Howard going into that big game?
I can tell you this, man. It's been a blessing, man, watching Howard. He was born on the same day, January the 12th, 1979. We probably live about 300-400 yards away from each other growing up in a little town of Donaldsonville, but our town was Lemonville, Louisiana. And you know what? Watching him play, and it's been, for me, very emotional, guys. I mean, I'm sitting there, you know, I'm watching the game at home. I'm crying. I'm in tears for Howard because he had an up-and-down roller coaster career. You know, I think, six, seven, eight teams. He's been in the league for 2 years. And then being on the field with the Green Bay Packers winning the Super Bowl, man. But I can tell you this. Prior to the Super Bowl, weeks before, I always used to call him. And then I know when they got into the playoffs, oh, I was saying, man, no, congratulations, man. You keep playing ball, and, you know, you'd be a leader in the locker room, man. It doesn't matter where you fit in on the team. It doesn't matter how much money you make. You know, it's about you being part of that team and playing ball and making those type of plays, man. And all the time, I remember the week of the Super Bowl, we talked about 5 or 6 times. Now, we're talking about enjoy the moment, enjoy the week, enjoy your family that's going to be there, enjoy this because you remember this for the rest of your life. And, you know, and just talk to some of the guys, or, you know, you take it one day at a time. You know, I was telling them. And when the game come, man, you're going to be nervous. You're going to have butterflies in the first half. You're going to have butterflies going into the second half. You know, but just play ball, play hard, because everybody is watching. You know, so that was the biggest thing, man.
Well, we're talking talking to Jarvis Green, Houston, Texas defensive end. And Jarvis, the big news in this offseason is the possible lockout. And as of yesterday, we're hearing reports that things are really not going well in the negotiations. In your mind, or is your agent or anybody telling you, or do you personally get the sense that we may have a lockout?
Oh, yes, guys, we will have a lockout. I mean, just the situation, what's going on. I can remember in the beginning, you know, all the stuff we was getting from our union and from our NFLPA reps with the teams. It was first the owners were talking about, you know, asking for $1 billion. Now you're hearing they talking about asking for $2 billion. I can remember last night, guys, I'm filling out my COBRA package for my insurance for my family. I have a wife and 3 kids, you know, sitting here looking at this reading documents, and I'm like, okay. They're very sincere about what's about to happen. So, last night, I'm filling my package out. You know, we're getting different emails. You know, you see the stuff on TV, people asking you questions. Man, this is real. This is going to happen. And like you said, we have a few days left before it's full effect.
And so if there is a lockout and games are missed, which means paychecks will be missed, How does a guy like yourself prepare for this possibility?
I can say this, guys. I've been ready for this a year ago, man. I mean, I have my plan B going now. I mean, I own a part of a construction company in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, called First Millennium. You know, I've been busy with that. You know, it's a great company. We've been doing a lot of work. We have a lot more work in front of us than behind us. And I tell some of the guys that I know, you know, personally, man, I have neighbors of Ryan Clark is one of my neighbors, and Randall Gay is one of my neighbors also. And I talk to those guys about just being prepared, man, getting ready for this, man, because this is real. And life after football is real. I mean, I'm 32 years old. I mean, right now, my better days are behind me. So I know, for me, whatever happens, I have to be prepared. I have to be ready. And, guys, I am ready for the real world. That's what I've been doing since I've been out of football kind of this year also.
So Jarvis, in terms of what the player reps, you know, talk to, like all the players, guys like yourself, how long, I mean, you seem to be pretty concrete on the fact that you're going, you know, out on a lockout. But how long do you guys expect this to last?
I don't even know. I don't have any idea. I mean, we have so much time right now, and the owners have so much time to get their stuff together. You know, the combine, well, this weekend, right, the combine. And then we have the draft coming up in April. So I don't know, guys. It could be past the starting day of training camp. We don't know. It could start. We could sign a deal in July. We could sign a deal in June. We don't have any idea. And we could ask our player reps. I guarantee they're going to say the same thing. We don't have a clue.
Wow. And Jarvis, you talked about your construction company, First Millennium. Tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, First Millennium, we do commercial, we do civil work. I mean, we have residential, but we don't do that. We do a lot of work with the government. We work under some big companies. And if you want to check out some of the companies we work with, is Walton-Core Construction Company. Walton-Core, we work with also Clark and McCarthy Company. Some big companies. I'm talking about these companies are billion-dollar companies. And we're working under them for the protege because my partner, he's a principal owner. His name is Nathan Hosley. He's been there for 18 years. So he has a lot of certifications for different work. And it's funny because things that Obama has done in the past is opening doors for small companies like we are. And I'm saying we're small, but, I mean, we're a $10 to $15 million company, as far as a year. And we're growing bigger and bigger, as I'm talking right now. And that's just something that I do, man. And hopefully I can help some retired players, some players that's in the area as far as helping them and getting them together with their plan B also. So it's our First Millennium Construction, and I'm here, man. I'm here to help other guys who need a helping hand also with this construction company.
So how did you get started or what put you in the position to start your construction company, because it seems like for you, this certainly will have eased the burden, you know, for not just a lockout, but certainly also, as you said, a transition, you know, into retirement from the NFL.
Guys, you know, I can tell you this. My second year in the league, I started an internship. I worked at Rolls-Royce Naval Marine Company in Walpole, Massachusetts. They do ship propellers for the Navy. They build gas turbines, pretty much the motor for the Navy. They have different divisions. You know, they do airplane jet motors or Boeing and all that stuff. But I started that my second year, and I did it for 2 years, my second and third year. And I did it more just to get nobody told me to do it. It's something that I wanted to do personally to get a head start on the real world. Because when I got into my first year in the league being a fourth-round pick, guys, to be honest, I said, you know what? I said, Lord willing, if you could bless me to play 2 or 3 years, I would be happy. Because I never thought I'd be sitting here going to my 10th season and the things that I've accomplished and the people that I've met. I've never thought that, you know. So my main thing was, you know, make a little change, get a little sign bonus, put it away, start my plan B right now, and that's what I've been doing. And I've been blessed enough to play and make the money that I've made, and I got into also the restaurant business. You know, I'm out of that now, but I did an internship for that also for 2 years while I was in Providence. But all of this was getting me ready for the real world. So myself walking into a boardroom meeting, talking to executives, that's like everyday stuff to me. That's like, you know, first nature for us, how to talk to them and just the things they're looking for, and that would prepare me because, like, the internships, I mean, when I got there, like I say, it was a real internship. It wasn't like the summer jobs that you get in college, you know, playing sports. It was a real real work, you know. So now I'm sitting here, and also at LSU, I majored in construction engineering, so I was very serious about what I was going to do after football to prepare myself. And I'm sitting here now, you know, 2011, and saying, hey, whatever happened with this lockout, man, I'm fine. I'm okay.
And Jarvis, in the next couple of weeks, you have some exciting things coming up. Next week, March 4th and 5th in Washington, D.C., at George Washington University, you will be attending the Sports Industry Networking and Career Conference. There, Jarvis,
yes.
you will be a part of a panel entitled Athletes Foundation, Marketing, and Management. Tell us a little bit about that, sir.
You know what? This same conference in Washington, D.C. at the George Washington University, this is something that my marketing guy, Eddie Rodman, been working on for the past 3 years, man. And they've been asking me to come out there and speak and be on the panel. And finally, I have the time to do this. And I'm very, very excited. This is something new for me. I mean, I do my speeches here and there. I speak. But this is going to be something different because I'm on a panel with some important guys, man, you know, some important guys in the sports world. And just for me to talk a little bit about what I've done with football, with my foundation, you know, also with my life after football, things that's going on. It's going to be a great opportunity, man. And I think it's going to have about 200 to 250 kids there asking questions about, you know, just the transition and just, I guess, the personal experiences that we have had as individuals.
And now, Jarvis, March 19th, you have a wine tasting gala for your charity. You're involved in many charitable endeavors. Talk about that March 19th event.
This is my fourth annual Jarvis Green Wine Tasting. It's for my Jarvis Green Foundation. We help disadvantaged single working mothers. And for this event here, well, we started after Hurricane Katrina. I think I mentioned that the first time I was on the show. But right now, we've been going so strong with the support and the money we've been raising. And up to date, I mean, we helped about 200 to 220 single mothers out there in the New Orleans, Baton Rouge, Providence, Boston area. And we're continuing to grow. You know, we need the support. Again, it's a wine event, man. We're having live music. We're going to have over 100 different wines. We're going to have musicians. We're going to have magicians, magic guys to the music. We're going to have fire eaters, fire dancers. And it's going to be a great event, man, just to raise money. And for me, I just love to have fun, love to meet people, networking at the same time. And I always let people know and tell people that, you know, you're spending this money, it's a write-off, but also you're helping our single working mothers. What's up, guys?
Well, I got to. Paul and I are probably running into the punchline because I got to be Paul. I got to tell you, a wine tasting event to me, that's an interesting way, you know, I think, to bring people together for a charitable event. What made you do the wine tasting, you know, as opposed to maybe like a meet and greet or getting other, you know, players involved?
You know what? I could have done a golf tournament. Hopefully we have something like that going on in the near future, basketball tournaments, different things like that. But for me, I guess going to the restaurant business, and I'm a big foodie, man. I love food. I love to eat. I love to taste different, you know, wines, beers, you know, whatever you call it. And just doing the wine thing, it was very important for me because we work with Johnson & Wales University also because they're a big sponsor also with the wine event. And we, the wine tasting is hosted at the Johnson & Wales Hotel in Seekonk, Massachusetts. So the big chef Ken Watt, he's a big chef there, important person, important figure, and all of this is wraps around because my wife goes to the Johnson & Wales also. So in Denver, so all this is a big circle, but it's a big support staff that I have. And again, personally, I'm a guy that loves to eat. Love to try new things, and doing a wine event, it was just something very, very personal to me. And I think a lot of people enjoy it also because last year we had like 650 people showed up, and in the last 3 years we had over 600 in attendance. You know, but this year we're trying to go for that 1,000, man. We're going to try to break it and go for 1,000 supporters for this wine event to raise this money.
And sounds like a wino's dream, Jarvis, so everybody definitely come.
I told you, I had to get my question in before he acted like a fool.
Yeah.
make sure everybody gets out there and supports the event. And Jarvis, real quickly, where can we find out information about all your upcoming events?
Well, you could go to jarvisgreen.com, and also you could check out my Twitter. My Twitter page is JG's Bayou's Finest. And I have my Facebook page, Jarvis Green fan page. You can get on that and accept, you know, to be a friend. I need some more support with that. And I have my Facebook page, Jarvis Green. And you can look at all those things to check out what's going on, what's upcoming events, and just to support the cause, man, because we're very serious about this. is very serious about helping single disadvantaged working mothers.
And Jarvis, that's a great cause, and it was definitely a pleasure to have you on today, sir. And we, again, would love to have you back in the near future. Good luck with everything.
Hey, thank you, guys, and y'all have a great day.
Take care.
Y'all too.
Jarvis Green, Houston, Texas, defensive end. And Jarvis has a lot of great events going on, so make sure you check those out and make sure you support this man as he's out here trying to do some great things in the community. So give him a lot of credit for that. And it was a pleasure talking to him. And speaking of life after football, we're going to now bring in former Redskin and former Eagles wide receiver, Darnarian McCants. Darnarian, how are you, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you, though?
We're doing great. Doing great, Darnarian. And Darnarian, you're a guy that played 4 years in the NFL, spent some time in Canada, and your career ended in 2009 in Canada. Did you think to yourself,
sort of, kind of,
what's next for me?
Yeah, I think, go ahead. I never really had a thought process behind it. Most of the moves I made is pretty much organic. I was just speaking to my wife the other day how, you know, I made it to the pros and I was happy, but it was almost like I was supposed to go because I was used to being an athlete all my life, you know. So it was like, okay, I'm going pro. Now it's just like, now it's time to take it to that next level. So most of my moves have been organic. You kind of get in the rut because you're used to a certain lifestyle, and in reality, the way I'm living now, in my opinion, is a lot harder than the NFL. But,
really?
You know, the different talents I've had, you know, the different talents I have, I figured it wasn't going to be too hard for me because it wasn't really a thought process. I know I'm an artist. I can sing. I can act. I can mentor. It's so many different variations and different things I've done that I knew I could help myself, you know, make money off of if need be.
And you were a guy throughout your NFL career who never really made the big money. Were you kind of sensible with your money throughout your career, kind of thinking in the future that eventually football would end? Or did you get caught up at some point in your life during your football career?
No. I never thought it was going to last as long as it did. I knew coming from Delaware State, you don't hear too many black college athletes performing for long periods of time. Sad to say, but you know, and then at the same time, it's very hard for, you know, the black college athlete to get to that next level of that, you know, the big money. You have your legends, you have your John Taylors, your Jerry Rices, your Walter Paytons, but it was that time and era for black college athletes to come out and shine just due to the fact the white schools weren't getting them. Once they started paying these kids to go to school, then, okay, things changed. So now at the NFL level, all you hear is Penn State, the U, Ohio, you know, is very little situations, very random and few that you hear, oh, well, he went to Boise State. Oh, well, he went to Delaware State, you know, because even when they shout out my man Jamal Jackson, who plays for the Philadelphia Eagles and was one of the reasons why they made it to the playoffs because he was the center, they never mentioned Delaware State.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
So is it a bias on some level? Is there a bias on some level?
It's not even a bias, but come on now. Like, okay, me personally, it only makes business sense. If I go to Delaware State and, okay, somebody from Harvard comes in, maybe qualified 10 times more than that guy from Delaware State, I'm going to pick my Delaware State guy.
Right.
Just because that Harvard guy's going to have another chance somewhere.
Well,
and it goes the same situation when I had Coach Schottenheimer. Guess what? We had over 10 people on the team from Penn State. When we had what's my man, Coach Spurrier, we had over damn 20 people on the team from Florida State. University of Florida. So that's just pretty much how the game is played, man. It's a good old boy system.
But Danae, you bring up it's a very interesting point, and I think you know, Jamal Jackson was a perfect example. If you look at most players, for example, I'll talk about, T.O. Terrell Owens. Very rarely, you know, do you hear about the fact, you know, that he came from, again, a very lesser-known school. But when you look at, and the same with Jerry Rice during his playing days, But when you look at a guy like Michael Irvin, I mean, he was a Dallas Cowboy first and always second a Miami Hurricane. And I mean, I wonder, especially as a former player, but you know, today when I'm sure you're mentoring, how does that translate to a young college athlete looking to go maybe and get a chance to play in a lesser-known school than, as you say, fighting his way, you know, at Penn State or at University of Miami, University of Florida?
In my opinion, you got to play to your level because you got to understand those guys who go to those big schools, one, have that ability, and not saying I didn't have the ability or another athlete didn't have that ability, but, you know, to an extent, they almost bred to go to where they go. You know, most of those guys are from Florida. Most of those guys are from Texas. Most of those guys are from California. So it rolls right into the part of where they go. You know, I'm from the DMV, the Maryland, D.C., Maryland, Virginia area. You know, more or less my size played in the part more than anything else, more than my talent. I never had that. I never played football all year round. You know, a lot of these guys are playing football year round from the age 8. So you ask me, by the time they're 18, they're professionals.
Wow.
So it's like, you know, to not – if I see a guy with tremendous ability, what you'll notice also, a lot of guys aren't trying to be the small fish in the big sea anymore. You got a whole bunch of guys dropping down to the 1AA's and balling out because now they get an opportunity to shine.
And was that kind of your mindset, or did you take what you pretty much was offered coming out of high school?
With me, I was a basketball guy. Most people don't understand. Most people don't know or don't even understand. Like, I played basketball. If anybody knew me or saw me, I had either Wilson or Spalding in my hand at all times. So when I went to play football, it was new. But the thing about it was, I got a scholarship for it. So
right.
I took advantage of the free education. My goal wasn't to go pro. My goal wasn't even to play, you know, football for 4 years. My goal was to get my degree and get the hell out of my mama's house.
And then you got the degree and you got the hell out of your mama's house. Denari, I want to switch gears kind of to athletes as they retire. According to Yahoo Sports article, 78% of athletes go pro 2 years after retirement. When you hear these numbers, are you surprised by it, or is it you're not surprised at all?
No, I'm not surprised by it, just due to the fact that you got to understand a lot of them come from low income. So when you never had nothing and now suddenly you think you got the world, you have this power, you have this confidence, you have this, you know, this leverage, because if you ever notice, some of them walk with a different swag when all of a sudden now they throw that NFL around. Some people become the NFL. See, I think to an extent, I don't say my downfall, but I never branded myself an NFL player. When people say a football player, I'm not a football player. I played the game. You know, some of these guys live and die. They, you know, they get the numbers on their chest. You know, they get tatted up with the team they play for. I am not football. Never will be. The game don't owe me nothing. I played the game. I loved it. It was what it was. I made some good money, and it's on to the next thing. You know, and I think guys get caught up in it because I know I've talked to my financial advisor, and it's like, oh, you're a pretty smart guy. I'm like, why do you say I'm smart? Because I'm not that going to blow my money on money, holes, and clothes? You know, but when you never had nothing, you know, that's what these guys get caught up in because that's what they see. They're young. Just give any 18-year-old $100,000. What do you think they're going to do with it? Especially
right.
if they've never been taught to maintain a steady bank account from the beginning.
So Jarvis, let me because I you bring up an interesting point. So let's look at where we are today in the NFL with an impending lockout and the fact that most of these athletes, as you're saying, I mean, money was water to them. And now, of course, you know, the well is dry, and it sounds like, you know, from the media, and certainly we just had Jarvis Green on saying that the players and the owners know that this is a foregone conclusion, a lockout. What is this going to do to the athletes of today's world, the NFL players' finances today?
It's hard to say. I'm hoping the athletes gain more leverage because the way I see it, you know, as an athlete, you know, they're making billions off our talent. I'm going to say ours. I'm not in the business anymore, but they're making billions off when T.O. came to the Eagles, guess who the number one selling jersey was? Right. T.O.
Right.
When T.O. left the Eagles, guess who the number one selling jersey was? T.O. Not Donovan, who's been there for the last 13 years. So, you know, they making billions of dollars. So I'm hoping that the players can gain more leverage. So, yeah, they can go to the markets they want to go to. So we can get, you know, get the money that's demanded. I'm like, okay, you're making $1 billion off my name and my number and my abilities. I should be able to get more than what you're going for. You know, because they're not putting no blood, sweat, and tears. You know, they always look at the athlete. They try to make the athlete look bad. But all they're doing is sitting in the office deciding who and who to screw and who to do.
And Darnell, you talked about the money holes and clothes. Was there any temptation? Did you find yourself almost getting caught up in that lifestyle?
Nah, man. It was boring. I tried it. It's a redundant thing. My first year, Wednesday through Saturday, I was in the streets. And by about that fourth or fifth week, I was like, it's the same thing. I seen her before, him, hey, you know, okay, she get drunk, okay, they leave, oh, he wrecked, you know. It's the same. I can't stand being redundant. And then even still, it wasn't helping me out in what I was trying to do. Anything I've tried to accomplish, for the most part, I've accomplished. And being in the streets, one part of it. There's no benefit. Okay, your social network are great. I haven't seen nobody get a check for that yet. But if I go ahead and score 6 touchdowns, I'm the third string, but leading leading score on the team, I got myself a $4 million contract.
Right. And Don Aaron, we talked about the NFL and a possible lockout. In your mind, in your opinion, do you think a lockout will happen?
Oh yeah, it's about that, man. It has to, because the thing about it, the owner's not trying to give up. I think it's like 40% or something. They're trying to lower the bar so they maintain their 40% then some. So you know, it's business. They trying to look out for themselves, and the players in the union trying to look out for the players, because you know I still ain't get why they don't take care of these older players that's going through these traumas, man. I go to certain meetings, you know, with some of the older players. That's how these dudes can't walk, man. You mean to tell me, you know, these are the legends. When Murray's off, you know, Franco Harris, you know, they still making money off their names on EA Sports, which is a $1 billion industry again. And I'm like, how often do you get a check for it? Because guess what? Your name is on it. You didn't sign up on your name. They can't own your name. They don't make you say
right.
that CBA. It doesn't say you give up the right to your name at all. You give up a lot of rights,
right.
But not to your name. Because if you notice, LeVar, when he first got in the business, he wouldn't sign it. And they never had a LeVar Arrington jersey that was legal. And it wasn't until his, like, fourth, fifth contract, which, you know, according to him, they tripped him. But it is what it is. Then all of a sudden you've seen LeVar jerseys. And guess what became the number one selling jersey for the Redskins?
So, Canary, in your mind, I mean, you've played in this league. If you were to be a part, I mean, if you were in the players' union, this, to me, has all the recipes of I think it's a game changer for a lot of the players if they can hold their ground. If the players can stay out long enough, I mean, because I agree with everything you're saying, that for far too long, I mean, sure, they're paid millions of dollars in present day, but once you're out of the league, there's another guy to take your spot, but the league is still raking in money in the sale of a jersey. So, you know, there is not, I think, an equitable distribution for overall. Do you see, you know, the players' union going after the long-term revenue rather than these contracts, signing bonus, guaranteed money? Are they going to try to get money over the long run?
In my opinion, if anything, they're going to go for the medical benefits, because that's, like, I'm only 32, bro, and I'm feeling pain that I shouldn't be feeling at 32. And I didn't have any major injuries. So I can't imagine with guys who have major injuries. You know, I got a little couple muscle tweaks here and there. You know, I still work out because I have a performance training program. But for the most part, man, I can't imagine dudes who had neck injuries, neck surgery, shoulder surgery. Oh, by the time they're 30 and plus, they're going to feel it, man. So if, in my opinion, if they're smart, they're going to go for them long-term medical benefits of like, okay, I need a check per week so I can get this therapy. Because basically,
right.
I still do the same therapy that I was taught on my shoulders so I can maintain them, because I know when I was like, okay, I'm going to chill for a little bit, my weight had dropped because I weren't lifting weights. And then, like, every injury I've ever had, I could feel. And I was like, okay, only way I'm going to maintain is if I maintain this weight. So I had to get my weight back up. So I'm back up to 215, 220. And for real, I had to do it just so I won't be in pain.
We're talking to Darnarian McCain, former Redskin, former Eagles wide receiver. And Darnarian, when you hear stories like Andre Waters 3 years back who committed suicide and there was a connection between concussions and that suicide, and then you hear a story about Dave Dorson. Right now they haven't made the connection, but it's looking like there is a possible connection there with concussions and depression. Do you kind of start looking at your career and kind of looking at maybe possible concussions you may have suffered throughout your career?
Oh, I know I have. And the thing about it, you don't give yourself credit for as many concussions that you do have, because I never realized that I was getting concussions until my last one. And then my last one probably was my most severe, and I think just due to the fact my body had been away from it for about a year and a half, so it wasn't used to hitting that ground. And
right.
I told the doctor when I went in, I was like, dude, I'm really having blackouts. Like, well, I will stand up and forget why I stood up to go and do what I wanted to do. And people were like, oh, everybody does that. This was happening every day. This was like, okay, I'm supposed to do something, and I can't remember what I'm supposed to do. And I was like, it really scared me, because I've seen, you know, the situations where a guy, you know, cool one day, and then he killed his whole family and himself the next day because he blamed out from, you know, for whatever reason. So it's a serious situation. And then the sad part is Europe's been studying over 20 years over us because of soccer. Soccer actually has more concussions than football, because a helmet is to protect your face, not necessarily prevent concussions. But in soccer, they get that ball is, dude, I've never, until I seen with the FIFA, that ball is humming, bro. they hitting that ball with their head, so it's like getting kicked in the head by a mule. So
right.
You've been studying concussions for years, and also because of rugby. Rugby doesn't play with helmets. So they're 20 years ahead of us, but yet, oh, we're just getting into this. Man, it's a business, man.
Hey, do you kind of... Do you monitor yourself whether or not, okay, I'm feeling a little blue today, I'm feeling a little depressed today? Do you kind of monitor that with all the situations that you're hearing now?
Oh, yeah, I definitely pay attention to myself, because I always tell my wife to make sure, you know, I ain't tripping. Because I don't want to be the one who, you know, take out my whole family and not even know I did it. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it on purpose.
Hey, man, we all know about that.
Yeah.
You're a very talented singer, a very talented artist. Let's start with your artwork. What inspired you to draw and to involve yourself in other types of graphic art?
Basically, it kept my ass out of trouble. I've always had a natural knack for it, but I stayed in a lot of trouble when I was younger. So eventually, you know, when you locked in the house for 2 or 3 weeks, you ain't got too much else to do. No Nintendo, no outside, you know, limited to maybe morning TV. And then, you know, you got to have that TV off before mom's coming to the house, you know. So I had to do something.
And we also talked about you being a talented singer. Where did that gift come from, and how did you begin to cultivate that gift?
Man, I was, I started singing when I was a baby, man. My aunt used to sing. So, you know, I kind of just mimicked her and, of course, Michael Jackson and everything else. So it was just something I can always do, man. Like I said, for the most part, this is just natural abilities that I knew I could utilize and take advantage of.
So do you want to utilize and take advantage of those talents right now on the air? Sing us a little something?
Sing something? I give you my song, Baby, Baby. I never knew this would feel so good. Can you tell me how you read my mind? Was it body motion? Made you feel my vibe? Was it in my eyes? Because eyes don't lie. Sort of stumbled into this feeling. And deep inside, my heart don't lie. This is beautiful. You're serious. Think it's marvelous. Because it's all about us. And that's, you can find it on iTunes, anywhere. Facebook me, whatever. You know, whoever's listening.
And so maybe we need to get that, and maybe I need to get that song for my wife and try to baby baby her and kind of get her in the mood.
Oh yeah, it'll get you. It'll get you. Yeah, respect. The second one is definitely that's all baby making music. My second CD called A Piece of Me. Yeah, that's if you're trying to touch on something, you definitely want to get the second CD.
Get the second.
And I'll keep that in mind, Darnarian.
For sure.
And where can we find out about your artwork and your music?
For the most part, you can Facebook me. Everything's under my first name. It's Darnarian. That's Darnarian. Have Darnarian.com, Facebook Darnarian, MySpace Darnarian. So everything is under my first name.
And everybody, make sure you check out Darnarian music, his artwork, and talk about your graphic art company.
Oh, I have a graphic artist company. Basically, it's photography. Mac Vision is my photography business. And then I have Pro Power Performance, which is my personal training and sports performance business. With my photography, something I started, and it's kind of I pick and choose, you know, what I do for the most part. But you know, it's building on itself.
And Darnarian, you talked about you're a personal trainer. I mean, any advice for people? I'm one who's trying to bring sexy back. Any advice for people out there who are trying to get their weight off and trying to get their bodies right in 2011?
Shoot, man. It's first off, you got to start with your diet. People got to pay attention to their diet. That's one. And then two, man, you got to understand and pay attention to technique, because we got a lot of people. I'm talking about professional athletes who do not know how they lift. People fail to realize that a lot of these guys who are in this league are just natural monsters. Like, you know, don't lift, smoke, drink, women every night, and come out and, you know, make 4 or 5 sacks. You know,
right.
But for those who need to, who have to work at it, you know, such as a brother like myself, you know, I'm in there every day trying to figure out how can I get better. I'm actually at this place right now called it's a seminar called the Bigger, Faster, Stronger program, which I pretty much grew up on. And I'm just basically reiterating my technique so I can utilize it with my kids.
Darnarian, it was a pleasure having you on today, sir. We appreciate your candor here today, and it was definitely a good time. So definitely want to have you back in the future.
Okay, cool.
Take care.
All right, man, thanks.
Darnarian McCann, former Redskin, former Eagles wide receiver, very talented man. Sang a nice little song for us in the audience. And, again, we wish him nothing but the best of luck in the future. And this past week, switching gears now real quickly, this past week the NBA trading deadline came and went, and guess what? We had a lot of deals go down, a lot of big deals. None bigger than Carmelo Anthony going to the Knicks. None bigger and Darren Williams going to the Nets. You also had Kendrick Perkins going to Oklahoma City in a move that shocked everybody, going to Oklahoma City for Jeff Green. And so a lot of different moves that happened this week. Baron Davis went to Cleveland in exchange for Mo Williams. So a lot of big deals that happened this week. And very interesting week in the NBA, and a lot of people right now at this point believe with the Knicks, with them acquiring Carmelo Anthony, also getting Chauncey Big Shot Billups, that the Knicks are a team that is very dangerous in the East, and which I agree with. I mean, you add Billups, who I think will be the part of the deal that won't get as much publicity, but I think it's going to be a big part of that deal, what Chauncey Billups can bring to that team. But you got Billups, Melo now, and Amari Stoudemire. So right now you have another big three, if you will, with the New York Knicks, with Melo, Stoudemire, and Chauncey Billups. And the Knicks will be a dangerous team. They did lose last night to the Cleveland Cavaliers. But if I'm somebody in that upper tier of the Eastern Conference, I don't really want to see the Knicks because of what Carmelo can do, because of what Stoudemire can do, and frankly, because of what Chauncey Billups can do and has done throughout his illustrious career. So, I really will not want to see the Knicks.
Well,
if
Paul,
I'm a team.
Let me ask you something, though, and honestly, think about this. I mean,
I hate to be the businessman, but we did say at the start of the show, we got reminded, but, you know, it is tax time, and I got my eye on the prize. If you're in the Knicks, you know, the brass, obviously it's important you come out now, you make this trade, and you want to stay, and you certainly want to be competitive, but, and I hate to be the guy to say this, but doesn't it make more sense to continue to tank this season and continue to, you know, they will essentially get, I mean, more value, like, longer term. If, you know, they're going to get a pick here for themselves that puts them maybe even in a lottery situation.
No, if you're the Knicks, no. I think if you're the Knicks in that situation, I mean, getting Carmelo Anthony, getting Amari Stoudemire, having an opportunity at Chauncey Billups, you're going for it, you're building something. I think it's a great move for the Knicks. And I think actually it was a great move for the Denver Nuggets, who've got a lot of talent in Raymond Felton, Gallinari, Wilson Chandler. I mean, they got a lot of different pieces there in that Melo deal. And so I thought, you know, it was a good trade for actually both teams. Obviously, you don't want to give up on a superstar like Carmelo Anthony, but you had no choice. You were put in the corner. You had to make a decision. And Melo obviously wanted out, and he got out. And so they had to make the deal. But I think it's a deal that worked out for him. And at this point, I think that deal is going to work out for him. And I also think that obviously the deal is going to work out for the New York Knicks. And they're going to be a dangerous team. They will be a dangerous team, and a team that I would be scared of if I'm in the Eastern Conference. And if, you know, they got 20-some-odd games to kind of gel and come together. And if they do that, it could be a problem. It could be a problem, but we'll definitely see what happens there. Also, another big deal, Kendrick Perkins goes to Oklahoma City for Jeff Green. And in that deal, if you're Oklahoma City, you get a level of toughness that you never had with Kendrick Perkins. They also added Nazi Muhammad as well, but you add size with Kendrick Perkins there. And a guy who's a top-notch, solid defensive center. He's a solid defensive center. So, I mean, that was a good move by Oklahoma City. And a lot of people are coming down on Boston, but I thought that was a fairly good move by Boston to get Jeff Green, the ever-versatile Jeff Green, a guy who can stretch the floor, who can guard multiple positions. He's 6'10". He's just a versatile player and a guy that has a lot of ability and a lot of talent. And so if you're Boston, you're obviously not making this deal if you don't believe that Shaq or Jermaine O'Neal are healthy enough. And I think obviously those guys, if those guys are healthy enough, they'll be fine. And let's not talk about Kendrick Perkins like he's Shaq when Shaq was doing his thing, or like he's Bill Russell or somebody like that. Yes, Kendrick Perkins is a tough, solid defensive center. But Kendrick Perkins isn't, you know, he's not Will, he's not Bill Russell, he's not even Shaq. So let's not get all saying, oh, Kendrick Perkins, like he's this big-time guy. Yes, Kendrick Perkins had a role on Boston, with the Boston Celtics, but Kendrick Perkins missed a big part of the season, and Boston was doing absolutely just fine. So let's not get all up in arms about losing Kendrick Perkins. I think it's going to be a good deal for both teams in this situation. You're
well,
Boston.
But you know as well as I do, Paul. I mean, the Celtics almost had to do this deal. They didn't want to. I don't think they wanted to give up Perkins by any means, and I completely agree with you. I think sometimes role players in a good system can, you know, they can come out looking better than they may because you hit the nail right on the head. I mean, the bottom line is Perkins was a great player for that organization, but like you said, I mean, Shaquille O'Neal or a Hall of Famer, he's certainly not. So at the end of the day, I think it does bear noting that, you know, this was a trade ultimately to make this year's Celtics team better, maybe not the Celtic organization overall better.
Yeah, I mean, and yes, time will tell. Like I said before, this deal is contingent upon the health of Shaq, the health of Jermaine O'Neal. But like I said before, they didn't have Jermaine O'Neal for all of the season. They didn't have Perk for most of the season, and they were doing absolutely positively just fine. And now you add a guy with the versatility of Jeff Green, a guy who's averaging 15 points a game in Jeff Green, a guy with a lot of ability and people seem to forget that. Jeff Green has ability. He has some ability. And so, again, I think it's a good deal for Boston, but I also think it's a good deal for Oklahoma City because Perkins fills a role. And that role is toughness. That role is rebounding. That role is deep, tough defense. And again, he did a great he did a good job on Dwight Howard, and it, a guy that many believe if he played Game 7 on the East of those Eastern not the Eastern Conference of the NBA Finals against the Los Angeles Lakers, if he played in that game, Boston would have won the ring and won that championship. I don't know about that because I believe Rasheed Wallace did have 15 points in that game. Kendrick Perkins would not have gotten 15 points in that game. So I don't know necessarily how true that is. And you will never know. And Doc Rivers has said it and stated throughout that this starting lineup from Rondo, Allen, Perkins, Pierce, and Garnett are undefeated in terms of championships, and they have never lost. That starting lineup has never lost. So has never lost a series. So, I mean, I guess that's going to change as well, so we'll see what happens because Perkins gone and Celtics have moved on also. Deron Williams was shipped to New Jersey. In return, the Jazz get Derek Favors, Devin Harris, and two first-round draft picks. So if in that situation, Deron Williams is going to Jersey, kind of gets the consolation prize, if you will, for not getting Melo. But Deron Williams is in New Jersey now. And the big thing is a year and a half from now, Deron Williams' contract is up. Does Deron Williams resign with the New Jersey Nets? And if he doesn't, how bad is this deal now for the Nets because they don't get a guarantee past next year? So it should be interesting to see what happens with that. But, I mean, if you're a Nets, you had to do it. You're going to Brooklyn in 2012. You want a superstar to open that building in Brooklyn. And Deron Williams fits the bill. And hopefully if you're a Nets fan, you can kind of build around that and hopefully make your situation ultimately better. And hopefully win some winning basketball to Brooklyn. We'll see what happens with that. I mean, the Nets still have some work to do. But, I mean, they have a good start with Deron Williams as their point guard. So, I mean, a lot of deals at the deadline. A lot of flurry at the deadline. And so, I mean, it should be interesting to see how the season concludes. But right now, with Perkins in Oklahoma City, that makes things a little interesting out west. And Perkins, if you're an Oklahoma City fan, will hopefully do what he has to do against the likes of an Andrew Bynum, against the likes of a Timmy Duncan. And so we'll see what happens. But, I mean, it's very interesting with the NBA trade deadline. Expected to be joined now shortly by Ashley Walker, the girlfriend of Rafer Alston, and one of the stars of VH1's Basketball Wives. Actually, we are now being joined by Ashley Walker from VH1's Basketball Wives. Ashley, how are you?
Good. How are you? How are you?
Doing well. And now, Ashley, on the show, VH1 Basketball Wives, you date former NBA point guard Rafer Alston. You guys have been dating for 4 years now, and you guys have a child together. Talk about how you guys met.
It was in Houston. It was after Hurricane Katrina. I was out here. And I'm from New Orleans, and we just met out here on my birthday, and it was 5 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so was that a good birthday present for you?
It was.
Sounds like it, Paul.
I can't complain.
And was there any reluctance in dating a professional athlete?
Yes and no. You know, at first I... Because you hear all the rumors and everything, but then you kind of go into it with, you know, it's your relationship.
Right.
So, I mean, it was kind of like a whirlwind thing at first. Then everything else hit you. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, you know. Hold on, you got to take a step back. But I did. I can honestly say I went into the relationship with no expectations. You know, I just went into it. Because at first, really, I wasn't. It was after Katrina. I wasn't trying to find a relationship or anything like that. So we had become friends. And I think that's what had helped with us. We had, you know, we just have become friends because I was dealing with Dad and he was helping me out. So that's, you know, we had developed a friendship.
And what attracted you to Ray for Austin?
I don't know if you've ever met him before, but if you ever met him, he's very funny. He's a clown all the time, and that's just how it was. And like I said, at that point in my life, you know, that's what I needed around, somebody who was just happy and always laughing and trying to make me laugh, especially at that point. So that was the biggest thing for me.
And now this is the first season. This is your first season on VH1
right.
Basketball-wise.
Right.
How did you go about getting on the show?
Oh, it's a long story. There was actually supposed to be a show like that in Houston with a cast of Houston Wives, and they actually wound up going with the show in Miami, and that was part of the cast in Houston. And so when they went to Miami, the network said they wanted me to do it. I declined for the first season. Then they called me again. I said no. They called me again. So, well, maybe, because, you know, they were saying it was going to be a different direction. It was going to be more wives and girlfriends on the show. They wanted to show what it was really like, you know. So after that, and they were saying it was going to be more wives and girlfriends, and they really wanted to go into showing the wives more about the women, that's how I agreed to do it.
And did you view it kind of as an opportunity?
I mean, you have to go into it like that. You have
right.
to. If you're just doing it just to like, oh, hey, I want to be on TV, then no. Yeah, I mean, you have to look at it as an opportunity to open doors for other things. Of course I did.
And we saw all the drama from the first season. Was there any apprehension after seeing all the drama on being a part? Was there any apprehension on your part to not be a part of the show?
Well, of course there was. You know, of course there was. I mean, I think for a lot of women, they would have feel the same way. Of course it was. You know, after seeing that, and I have kids, and, you know, I'm still in a relationship, I didn't want to necessarily be a part of that because that's just not who I am anyway. I'm not a drama-filled person, so I didn't really necessarily
right.
want to be a part of the drama. But when it was told to me that, you know, they were going in a different direction and they really did want to show the family and, you know, that kind of thing, that's what made me agree to do it.
Go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
It's interesting because you talk about the drama.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go on those shows and successfully kind of stay out of the, you know, of the character that certainly the editors are trying to make it seems like everyone be?
Right. You be yourself. That's the only
right.
answer. You be yourself, and that's who I really am. That's who I am. I'm not into the drama. I could care less about any of that, who he said, she said, and any of that. You know, I'm just, you be yourself, and you. What happens is the show, it magnifies who you are.
Right.
And, so if you're not part of the drama, you're going to stay out of it. No matter what, you're going to stay out of it. And for me, I stayed out of it because it just wasn't worth it. And so it showed
right.
who I really was.
And speaking of drama, you were part of some drama on the show. Jennifer Williams, the wife of Eric, she stated that you allegedly posted a phone number and a picture of a friend of hers named Lauren, which is Rafer's former fiance, on Craigslist. Apparently, she said he posted her name and phone number on Craigslist. Kind of set the record straight for all of us.
The only record that can be straightened is that it's not true. I mean, it's not true. For the person I am, if it was, I would gladly be like, oh, yeah, I did it, and I don't care. But
right.
no, that's not true in any sense of the word. I don't know if it was the show or what, but no, that's not true.
When that comes out, especially, you know, during the show, I mean, where do you go there? How do you, you know, how do you move on and carry forward? It seems like to you it just kind of rolls right off your back.
Yeah, you know why? Because I think because it doesn't, that show doesn't define who I am. You know, we have kids. We, you know, I'm a mom, teen mom. on my son's baseball team. You know, I run my own foundation. So I have my own life. And so the show doesn't define who I am. So it just, it's like whatever.
Right. And why do you think she would do something like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, maybe it was for the show. I mean, I don't know. You know, I have
right.
no clue at all. I've never held a conversation with her or anything like that. But I don't know.
Right.
But I know it's not true. And so that's why I just laugh it off, because it's kind of like I was very caught off guard by it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I had to laugh. I was like, is this serious? Like, is she serious right now? You know, but
right.
I didn't entertain it at all because it's not true. So there was no need for me to entertain it.
We're talking to Ashley Walker, girlfriend of Rafer Austin, and one of the stars of VH1's Basketball Wives. And there was some more drama involving you. We saw what happened at the charity event. You had Jennifer and Evelyn, who were not invited to the event. They eventually would crash the event. When you saw those two walk into your charity event, what was your reaction?
You know, I laughed because I was like, I guess I was surprised, but then I wasn't, because after meeting them and, you know, Jennifer asked some questions, like, I was like, anything's possible. And so at that point, I was just like, anything's possible. And so when they came in, I wasn't necessarily mad, because it was my foundation's charity event, you know. So to me, I'm like, okay, well, if they came, that must mean they actually wanted to be here, you know. That's what I'm
right.
thinking in my head, like, they really wanted to be here. So I just kind of laughed and to myself thinking, wow, this is crazy. But I went on with my charity event, you know, because to me that was the most important thing.
Right.
And then, you know, you saw what unfolded after that.
Yeah. And we talked about, we saw what unfolded. And unfortunately, during that charity event, Jennifer and Tammy Roman, another star of the show, eventually would get into some kind of altercation. When you saw that altercation, you had to be a little upset, because this was your charity event.
Yeah, you know, I was upset. Tammy and I are cool. She apologized on camera, off camera, everything. Like, you know, I was upset. I was upset with a lot of things. I was upset with production. I was upset about the whole thing, because for me, that was an actual charity event. Like, I wasn't just doing this for the show. You know, like, that was my actual charity event I was doing that they just wanted to film. So I was very upset afterwards, because I'm like, this, you know, this is just something I was doing for the show.
Right.
So it really did upset me, you know, but then I got over it, because I was like, you know, I just got to move on, keep going on my foundation, do more fundraisers, whatever. But initially, afterwards, I definitely could say I was really upset.
Do you have a relationship with Jennifer or Evelyn? Because it seems like those two like to talk a lot of trash about you.
No, I don't. And you know what? I don't say anything about anybody. For me, it's like, it's not that serious. It's
right.
just a show. So, you know, I don't even think, like, it doesn't bother me at all. You know, we just
right.
don't have a relationship or anything like that. I thought everyone was actually kind of cool, because she did talk to me off camera. You know, she would, like, speak and stuff. She was actually cool. But, it doesn't bother me at all.
And do you have a relationship with any of the girls in terms of a friendship?
I do. Royce and I are actually friends. We talk regularly. Actually, we talk about it every day.
Wow.
I'm friends with Susie. We talk regularly. Tammy and I... we still talk, and, you know, we'll text see how each other's doing, or call, you know, just to check in, see how each other's doing. And actually, Gloria and I talk.
Okay. And speaking of Evelyn and Jennifer, last week, speaking of talking trash, they were saying that Rafer has someone else in the New Jersey area, and they were basically referring to you as a quote-unquote jump-off. Kind of give us the true story about this.
Oh, well, no, I mean, the true story is Mace and I are together. We have a family. Like I said, I don't entertain any of that. Like, I didn't even see that episode, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I mean, there's no reason for me to entertain any of that, like, at all. That, you know, like, I don't, it's a reality show. You've got to say something,
right,
basically. I think that's what people kind of fail to realize who watch these shows. There's got to be something so people can watch it. And, you know, unfortunately, it involves people's relationships and, you know, things like that. But, you know, and I don't talk bad about the show. I don't complain because I signed up to do it. So whatever comes along with it, you know, I got to suck it up and take it. But as far as that goes, it's like I just... Again, I really laughed at that because I was like, whatever. But, I mean, and then at the end of the day, I really didn't entertain it because, of course, you saw Rafer and I together at the end, you
right.
know. So it was kind of like there was nothing for me to say because that was the answer right there.
Does it get tiresome? I mean, you certainly do the show to get some notoriety. But does the you know, and you called it to the production and the fact that, like, they could have recognized, you know, when a scene starts at a charity event, rather than, you know, show that, it could have, the editors and the production people can always edit things in or edit things out. Do these reality shows in the end, do they sometimes prove to be not as valuable as they may appear on the surface?
I'm gonna say that to each its own. That's how I'm gonna answer that one. I'm gonna answer that one by just saying to each its own. I have definitely learned a lot being on this, you know. I just know for me, first and foremost, my family is the most important thing, you know, after God. And,
right.
And I'm gonna protect my family. I didn't discuss my relationship. I didn't discuss my kids because I chose not to. You know, and
right.
at first, and when people were telling me about the episode this past week, and I was like, you know what, I shouldn't even have had him film because, you know, people were like, aren't you glad you proved? And I said, well, I have nothing to prove to anyone. I have nothing to prove to no one at all. And so I'm like, you know what, I could have not even had him film because I have nothing to prove to anybody, you know, no matter
right.
what said, no matter who says what, I don't. Nobody needs to know what goes on in my house, good or bad. So, you know, afterwards I thought about it, I was kind of like, maybe I shouldn't even have had him film because it wasn't even worth it. But,
right.
you know, as far as editing and stuff, yeah, they're going to edit and they're going to do what they want to do to make it a show.
And it's such a lot of artificial drama, if you will.
You know. It's drama, you know. It's what happens is they put you in a situation that you normally wouldn't put yourself in, and then
right.
you react to that situation.
We're talking to Ashley Walker, one of the stars of VH1's Basketball Wives. It airs each and every Sunday at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock Central. Now, you guys actually bought some shoes from Evelyn's store. That was
yeah.
a lot of shoes, actually. Any regrets with that purchase?
No, I mean, they were really nice shoes. She actually has nice shoes in her store. I love shoes. I love handbags. You know, I used to buy them a lot. I don't buy them as much anymore because I realize they really, you know, they are really our materialistic things, and my focus really is on, you know, somewhere else now. But, I mean, I love shoes. I love handbags. She has nice shoes. Those are some fly shoes, and I wanted them, you know, so we bought them.
Are they still in the closet?
Yeah. I wear them all the time.
Okay. Now, many people don't know this about you, but you actually were a school teacher. Tell us about that.
I was a fifth grade teacher.
Wow.
And I stopped to take care of the kids and stuff, but I'm going to go back and counsel them, but I started my foundation, and then I founded a mentoring program for teen girls. I started a foundation and where I do a mission trip to Africa every year. I do, I'm from New Orleans, so I do a renovation project in New Orleans right now for an elementary school, buying their instruments for the band. And then I do a I founded a program called A Girl's Life, and I mentor teenage girls.
Yep.
And that was another reason why I couldn't really, you know, I can't really entertain a drama. I mean, I have, you know, I mentor, you know, I'm the founder and mentor of teen girls. They can't see me on there acting crazy, and I'm telling them to do, you know, the total opposite. So, you know, that's who I am.
And if there is a third season of Basketball Wives, would you return?
I don't know. I can't answer. That's something that we have to discuss and, you know, just make a decision based on what's best for our family and our kids and really what's best for me.
Right. And now, Ashley, where can we find information about you and your many charitable endeavors?
My personal website is realashleywalker.com, and my foundation's website is awmissionlove.org.
And will you appear on any more episodes of Basketball Wives in this season?
Well, you know what? They have one more episode left.
Okay.
Not on that last episode, but then after that is the reunion.
Okay, and you will be a part of that?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. All right. Again, you can check out Ashley and all the rest of the girls on VH1's Basketball Wives each and every Sunday on VH1, 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern, 7 o'clock Central. And again, you can check out Ashley at realashleywalker.com. Make sure you check out her website. She got some nice music there.
Oh, thanks. I know I like it too, right? You be bobbing your head when you're looking at it.
I did. I actually kept the website up to hear the music. I mean, it's
I know.
It's
I like
music.
That's why I picked it. That's why I picked it. I liked it too.
Well, not only, I guess, you have good taste in shoes, but you have good taste in music.
Thank you.
Ashley, it was a pleasure talking to you.
We wish you too.
Rafer nothing but the best of luck in the future.
Thank you.
And hopefully you get married soon.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Ashley.
Thanks.
Ashley Walker, Basketball Wives.
They got to get you on stand-up one of these days, Paul. You really are missing your calling. If you take it from a guy that's only known you about 30 years, you really, you, Jerry Seinfeld, a lot in common. Funny guy.
You know, I try. We're going to be joined by Lee Steinberg very shortly. Before we go to Lee, this is actually on a personal note. This is actually a special day for someone that I know very well. My son Jermaine. He turns 9 years old today. Today is February 26th. Today is his birthday. So happy birthday to him if he's out there listening. Happy birthday, champ. So it's his birthday, and we will be celebrating it later today. Jeremy?
I was going to say, Paul, I mean, we're certainly waiting for the invite down here at 226. Sure it's in the mail.
It's going to be nothing major. Nothing major at all. Quite frankly. But we're going to be joined by Lee Steinberg very shortly now. Lee's going to kind of break down what's going on with these CBA negotiations. We are now being joined by super agent, sports attorney, Lee Steinberg. Lee, how are you today, sir?
Doing great, Paul. Glad to be with you.
Now, Lee, last week in the NFL and its players essentially agreed to non-binding federal arbitration. Being a guy who's been involved in many negotiations throughout your career, describe what may be going on in these negotiations.
Well, what they did was they agreed to a mediator. And what happens in a mediation is that each party sits in a separate room. And the mediator comes in, and essentially his job is to scare each party to death about what happens if they don't make an agreement. So he'll tell each party that their position is very, very dire and put as much pressure as he can to try to push the parties together. It's non-binding. You know, I've been doing this since 1975, and the year after I started, two teams came into the NFL, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and the Seattle Seahawks. Their purchase price was $16.5 million. Today, every team in the NFL averages $1 billion. The TV revenue back in 1976 was $2 million per team per season. Now it's about $130 million. The NFL is rolling in economic largesse. It's by 2-1 the most popular sport in the country. It had a record-breaking Super Bowl ratings. It had a record-breaking Jets against the Steelers ratings. This is the height of the sport, and the reason for that, Paul, is because since 1987, every game has been played, and it hasn't had the problems of baseball and basketball and hockey. And I don't think that force-feeding fans a diet of billionaires negotiating with millionaires will be very good for the sport. No one wants to kill this golden goose.
And you talked about many of these franchises being worth $1 billion. According to Forbes magazine, 19 of the 32 NFL teams are worth over $1 billion. And you have the league essentially, like you said, basically printing money at this point. Other than maybe the rookie wage scale, what's wrong with this current system? Why not keep it the way it is?
Well, frankly, the reality is that the current system works, and because the games are played, there's been tremendous focus on building the brand and creating the NFL Network and creating fantasy football, creating a variety of different ways, if you watch DirecTV, to make it more enjoyable. And there's no talk of labor problems. So football has been unique, and all of the energy has gone into creating more revenue for the sport. So it would be a disaster to allow the problems that either side has to overwhelm this. Take the issue, for example, of 18 games. I think that the human body can only withstand so much pounding. And the physics of the hit have changed. I mean, we never anticipated you would have a defensive lineman who was 6'5 and weighed 305 who could run a 4.8 40 and hit a quarterback. And by the time we get to the end of a season, the players' bodies are just about ready to go through a long rest. So when you add two more games, what will happen is the injury rate will go sky high. And now, right, because of the cap system, we don't have key players backed up by players that are just a little bit worse than they are. You drop from a starter to a rookie or an aging veteran. So it has a real impact on a playoff race. The other thing that happens is if you get down to game 17 and 18, what would happen is that teams that were already clinched would play their backups. So those games, ironically, would look very, very similar to the third and fourth preseason game anyway.
And you talked about the 18-game schedule, and to your point, the Green Bay Packers, the world champion Green Bay Packers, they had 15 players on injured reserve this season. Now, you've been around a lot of players. You've represented a lot of players. And talking to some of your players, what is the sense that you get from them in terms of this 18-game schedule?
Again, 18 games in a sport that is a collision sport is a recipe for disaster. It would, and you can't look at this without understanding that the salary cap means that the depth in football is very thin. No longer can a team have five all-pro offensive linemen line up against each other in the starting lineup. They can't afford the cap dollars, even if they could afford to pay them. So you get a very uneven level of play. and injuries will play a disproportionate role. And the football can look very ragged and sloppy, and we risk really serious injuries. One of my concerns has been the whole concussion situation, and this was a ticking time bomb that back in the 90s I held a series of player safety conferences to address, because we didn't realize the long-term impact that was occurring. Now we realize that three or more concussions can trigger long-term implications like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, premature senility, depression. We just saw Dave Duerson in a tragedy where he killed himself from what's suspected to be a brain syndrome that occurs from too many concussions. And we need to take that issue seriously because, you know, it's different than other injuries. We know that players at the end of a long career may, at age 40, have problems leaning over to pick up their children. It's another thing not to be able to recognize their children.
And like you said, you talked about Dave Duerson, and we had the situation a few years back with Andre Waters, and that sad situation is a sad story. And one of the issues that the owners and the players seem to be fighting over is the rookie wage scale. Last season, we look at it, we had Sam Bradford, number one pick for the Rams, signed a 6-year, $78 million deal, 50 of which was guaranteed. And this was all before we took a snap. In your mind, does something need to be done in terms of a rookie wage scale?
You know, I've been representing top draft picks since 1975, and I've had about 60 first-round draft picks in the very first player drafted in the first round in 8 separate years. But I would never tell you that the system is especially rational, because what happens is at the very top of the first round, we see enormous amounts of guaranteed money. And it drops off drastically, even in the middle of the first round, down to the bottom of the first round. And yet history would tell you that many of the players in the second round, third round, turn out to be better players than some of the missed picks in the first round. So the system's never been rational. What they attempted to do back in 1993 was to take some of the money that was going to unproven young players and give it to proven productive starters, and they passed a rookie wage scale. The problem was that we found ways around it. So the first contract done under that was Drew Bledsoe, and I created a structure that was voidable years, so he ended up making virtually $17 million in signing bonus over his first 2 years. So there was a system, but I don't think anyone would argue that if there is a certain amount of money that's allocated towards players and there's agreement over what that money is, that more of it should go to veterans and should go to rookies.
And we're talking to Lee Steinberg, excuse me, super agent, sports attorney. And Lee, at this point, the battle seems to be over that $1 billion of revenue. As we currently sit, it's a 53-47% split, 53-47 in terms of the players, in favor of the players. Right now, I mean, the owners want to change that. Basically, what they want to do, they want it the other way. They want it 55-45 in favor of the owners. We talked about all the money that the league is making. We talked about everything. How realistic is it to ask the players to essentially take a pay cut?
If this were a situation where you had teams claiming economic necessity and opening their books, then you could perhaps understand it. Now, let's be straight about one point. We need owners to be successful. We need them to make profit. We need them to be incentivized to want to own franchises, to put money into new stadia, to be willing to compensate players so that I think that the key to this all is a partnership, really, in some sense, as the players and owners are in this together, because the competition for the NFL, if you really think about it, is not players versus owners. It's competition against baseball, basketball, home box office, Walt Disney World, and every other form of discretionary entertainment spending. It's a battle for consumer dollars. And once these formulas are worked out, it's in the interest of players and owners to band together to woo the fans to continue to create a bigger pot. So this whole session of bargaining needs to be done as quietly as possible, because this is a very tough economic time in this country. And I can't imagine that you will have a whole lot of people with a whole lot of sympathy, frankly, for either side, because
right.
You've got billionaires on the one side and millionaires on the other side, and the average working family in this country, you know, survives on $40,000,
$45,000. And Lee, you represented the biggest and the brightest in the world of sports, Steve Young, Troy Aikman, Ben Roethlisberger, to name a few. What would be your advice to players if there was a lockout?
To understand that if that occurs, it's not the end of the world. Pro football, I want to give great credit to both sides for the fact that they're working so hard at this point. Because normally what happens in pro football is no one does anything in a business sense until the very end. If you take a look at draft picks, they get drafted in April, but the negotiations for the first rounders don't even get going until July. And the whole sport is institutionalized so that when it becomes an issue that will negatively impact a franchise, then they go ahead and focus on it and they move. Until then, it's not the number one priority. So that, as far as I'm concerned, no football is being played in March or April or May or June or July. Training camps would open, you know, in August. So from that perspective, it would be better not to ratchet up the labor atmosphere another level and have the sides face off against each other. But I'm not totally sure that at the end of the day we'll know the true positions of anyone until the games or training camp come around.
Talking to Lee Steinberg, super agent, sports attorney. Now, Lee, if there was to be a lockout, and we talked about the profits, the revenue that the NFL is making, essentially how they're printing money, who would be to blame, if anybody, if there was a lockout?
Well, if you're talking about a lockout that caused missed games, then, you know, both sides would have to share some of the blame. But I can't anticipate that either side and ultimately the owners would be suicidal enough to do that. Again, we're sitting in it's February, and obviously there's a March 4 deadline, but the point is no football is being played, and this is the off season. And when it really comes down to actually missing games, that apocalypse, when people peer into it, when they stare into the dark abyss, it strikes me that cooler heads will prevail.
And Lee, you saw this before back in 1987 when Scabs were essentially playing football. It was a bad brand of football. But kind of take us through what happened back in 1987 in terms of the type of football that we saw when we had essentially Scabs playing.
Well, what happened was that at a certain level, the fact that they ran NFL graphics with NFL announcers meant that for some people they couldn't really tell the difference other than the fact the stars weren't there because it looked like an NFL game. It had the same graphics. It had the same production values. It had the same announcers, just didn't have the same stars. And then what ultimately happened was that players like Joe Montana and Howie Long crossed the picket line. So what occurred was that ultimately the union decertified itself. Because what happens is that under labor law, if there's an impasse between a union and management, then the management can go ahead and temporarily put in temporary wages, terms, conditions. To avoid that happening, the union decertified. So they, in essence, said to management, you can't do anything to change the system because there's no one to negotiate with because the players aren't being represented.
Right.
And the way it was resolved was that the union at that point couldn't charge its members mandatory dues. A lot of the marketing money that would have gone today to the players under Players, Inc. actually went to the NFL because the quarterbacks formed the quarterback club, and that money went to NFL properties, and many other players signed that way. Ultimately, what resolved everything is the free agency case in Minnesota under Judge Doty was won by the players, and it's called either the Freeman McNeil or the Reggie White case, and Judge Doty won free agency for the first time, free agency for the first time for the players. And so that forced the parties back together to bargain, and then they bargained a new collective bargaining agreement.
Now, Lee, March 3rd, the CBA expires. We talked, like I said before, growing ratings, a lot of profits going on right now. At the end of the day, will there be a lockout in your mind?
Again, I think that I want you to distinguish between whether or not a lockout is declared, declared in March, meaning that there might not be mini camps, that the draft might be imperiled, that the football business as we would expect it to play out over the off season might be negatively impacted, and a labor impasse or dispute that would actually jeopardize the regular season. Most NFL negotiations go to the very end. So you just have to define what the end is. And look at it every year. The draft picks in the first round are not signed when training camp begins. Very few of them. And then magically, within about a week, even though they're a day or two late in most cases, they're all signed because there's focus. So I can't imagine that the NFL would be prepared to face the enormity of the fan, season ticket holder, television, marketing reaction that would occur with a strike or a lockout.
And Lee, you talked about your work with concussions, and we talked about earlier the situation with Dave Dorson and also the situation with Andre Waters a few years back. And you represented two guys who had issues with concussions in Steve Young and Troy Aikman. At this point, has the NFL done enough in terms of concussions and trying to limit concussions?
I'd look at this two ways. Under Roger Goodell, the Berlin Wall that existed, where there was almost total denial that concussion was a problem, has been broken. And there's been more focus in the last couple years than there was in the previous 100. So the good news is that under Commissioner Goodell, there's been a tremendous amount of focus. Is it enough? No, it's not enough. I started holding concussion seminars back in the 90s because I had players like Steve Young and Troy Aikman. There came a game where the 49ers were playing the Dallas Cowboys down in Dallas, and I was representing both Steve Young and Troy Aikman. Well, the Cowboys won, but Troy suffered a concussion, and I went to see him in a darkened hospital room in downtown Dallas after the game, and he was sitting there, and I walked in, and he smiled, and he said, you know, where am I? And I said, you're, you know, in the hospital. What? Why am I here? Well, you suffered a concussion. Did I play today? Yes, you played. Did I play well? Yes. Did we win? Yes. What's that mean? Well, you get to go to the Super Bowl. And his face brightened, and he got excited. Well, about 5 minutes passed, and he looked back at me and said, well, why am I here? You know, did we play today? He asked exactly the same questions. And so I answered him, and his face brightened again. And then another 10 minutes passed, and Troy looked at me and said, what am I doing here? Well, that experience totally traumatized me in terms of the fact that the tender line between being totally cognitively functional and being in a state of dementia is just so thin. And so we started to hold concussion conferences, and I got the brightest neurologists from across the country. And we really knew very little, but the instrumentation's become better. And so we proposed that the head not be used for blocking and tackling, and that, and I at least made sure that the players we had then, the, you know, the Mark Brunells, the Drew Bledsoes, the different players, the Rob Johnsons, were able to come and hear it. And but it was only later in the last couple of years that the really talented researchers, the Kevin Guskowitzes, the Julian Bales, the Bob Cantus, the Robert Hovdas, came up with the smoking gun. And what they found was that three or more concussions is the critical point. And once a player's had that, he is at risk for all of the whether it's premature senility, Alzheimer's, depression, all of these later problems. And the problem is that players are in a state of denial. They, from Pop Warner on, want to play. They don't want to be left out. Right. They don't want to be, you know, marginalized, so that they're not very honest about it. What furthermore we found out was that the adolescent brain is really at risk. And so the real danger is that a younger player, a high schooler, will get a concussion and it won't be diagnosed. And then he'll go out and play too quickly. And then he'll get two. And if it takes a really hard hit to do the first one, it takes much less to do the second, and the player has slowed reflexes. So the antidote to this is baseline testing, where you give a player a cognitive test prior to going out on the field to play. And then if he has an injury to his head, you give a second test. Then, and parents need to know this, that young person needs to be asymptomatic or free of symptoms at rest, on an exercise cycle, at practice, before they go back out on the field to play.
And now, Lee, switching gears now, your life essentially was based on the movie Jerry Maguire, starring Tom Cruise. How humbling of an experience was that?
Well, you know, Cameron Crowe called me up in 1993, and he was a writer and a director, and I had seen the film Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which was based on him going underground in a school and pretending he was a high schooler. So I thought that was terrific. And he asked if he could follow me around and go wherever I went to pick up some atmosphere or background for a film that would follow the life of a sports agent. So we started out in 93, and we went to the league meetings, the NFL meetings that were held in Palm Desert. And then we went to the draft. I had Drew Bledsoe that year, so he was the first pick in the draft. And, you know, Cameron asked, well, what would your nightmare be? And I'd say, well, what if I ended up not representing this player? Somebody else took him, you know. And then we went up to meet with Bill Parcells. And then Cameron came to Pro Scouting Day at SC. He came to the Super Bowl. He sat like a little fly on the wall watching negotiations in my office and came to a number of games and spent time with me and with the players. And part of my job was to vet the script, because the key in a sports movie is that the willing suspension of disbelief, which is, you know, your ability to lose yourself in that movie and not think it's real phony, is that the dialogue can't be totally stereotyped or canned, and the look has to be right. So they came to my office and took my yellow legal pads. They took pictures off the wall and stuck Tom Cruise's head where mine was. I actually took Cuba Gooding Jr. down to the Super Bowl in Phoenix and made him pretend he was a wide receiver for a week. And
wow.
So I worked with the actors. And now, there was a player named Tim McDonald who was a strong safety for Arizona. And under the Freeman McNeil case, he became a total free agent in 93. And so I was marching him around, showing him off to teams, trying to get people to bid on him in 93 in Palm Desert. And Cameron went upstairs to Tim's room and interviewed him, and he said, Tim, what are you really looking for in this process? And Moneyline was on in the background. And Moneyline was on, and he gestured up to the screen with, you know, with Lou Dobbs. And Tim said, well, I'm trying to get someone to show me some security. I'm trying to get someone to show me some respect. I'm trying to get someone to show me some economic recompense. And Cameron went off and wrote the line, show me the money.
Wow. That's a great story there. Lee, we thank you for stopping by, sir. It was greatly appreciated. And where can we check out information about Lee Steinberg?
Well, SteinbergSports.com. And I tweet on Steinberg Sports, and I'm on email, and we have a website, Steinberg Sports, and, you know, welcome to check it out.
Lee, it was a pleasure talking to you, sir. We wish you nothing but the best of luck in the future, and we'd love to have you back in the future as well.
We can do it anytime. My pleasure.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Lee Steinberg, super agent, sports attorney, and Lee's a guy who's been through it all in terms of negotiations, so he was a perfect guy to bring on and talk about what may be going on in with the NFL and the Players Association during their mediation sessions and during their negotiating sessions, and as they try to hammer out some kind of agreement. I don't know.
It makes you wonder, Paul. It certainly, I think, for me, you know, hearing Jarvis Green, Denari McCann, the two players, it does very much seem like these players, they're not afraid to admit that, you know, they want to get what's coming to them, and they're not afraid, it looks like, to, you know, to call the owner's bluff here.
I mean, like Lee Steinberg pointed out, I mean, and like we said throughout the show, millionaires against billionaires, the haves versus the haves. And no sympathy, really, from the fans when you have the haves against the haves. And like I said before, the economy is jacked up. People are out of jobs. Unemployment is up. I mean, you know what? Get on the field. Make this thing work. You guys are making billions upon billions of dollars. Make this thing work. You got some smart minds in the room. You got some brilliant minds in the room. Find a way to get this thing done. I mean, it's
It's plain and simple. Find a way to get this thing done. I mean,
well,
I just don't.
I mean, I think everyone. I don't disagree. I think that I agree. One of the things Lee said that I thought was very telling, it because I think it was very well said as well. They're really, Paul, playing with fire, the NFL, to go into a lockout, because as he showed, history shows teams do not bounce back well from the lockouts. The owners, the players, the league in general, and in an economy like this, it'll be all over ESPN. It'll be on, you know, the news channels, because it will be, you know, a story that certainly I think will it's something I think people will, a public interest, if you will, watching these millionaires and billionaires fight it out when everyone else is on unemployment.
You're right. I mean, I mean, it's essentially, you're not going to get sympathy from people. Will people ultimately come back if there was a lockout and games are missed? Yes, people will come back. They'll be back. It's just a matter of when. And in terms of the NFL, fantasy football, suicide pools, you name, I mean, and a bunch of other things. I mean, people kind of base their lives around the National Football League. I mean, Super Bowl is basically a holiday. Super Bowl Sunday is essentially a holiday. I mean, the ratings were great. The ratings were great for everything this year. I mean, the ratings were great. You got great ratings. People love your product. You are printing money. People are wearing jerseys left and right. You are printing money. Television stations are paying you left and right. You are printing money. Find a way to get this thing done. I mean, it's kind of as simple as that. Get this thing
really
done.
Is. I think though the problem is it's such a huge impasse, Paul, in terms of for the players. This is the first, probably, and who knows, you know, how long until the next chance they're going to get to have some equity, if you will, you know, in their brand. And that's important for these players, you know, to keep in mind. This is the first, and as I said, maybe the last time for a long time, they're going to get a chance to reconcile, if you will, you know, their ability to have the ship righted on their end.
And like I said before, they're battling over that $1 billion. Right now, like I said before, and I talked to Lee about it when I was talking to Lee, 53-47 in favor of the players. The percentages in terms of the money and the distribution of the money. 52% to the players, 47% to the owners. And so that's the way it breaks down here. And the owners want to flip-flop that thing, if you will, and have 55% owners and 45% players. And so does it get done? I can't see how the players would agree to that. It's a stalemate. It's definitely a stalemate. Will we be in a situation back in 1987 where we have basically replacement players coming in and playing and masquerading as Michael Vick and masquerading as Adrian Peterson, masquerading as other football players? I mean, will it be that situation, masquerading as a Jarvis Green, if you will? Will it be that situation? I mean, I remember back in 1987, I was 11 years old when that happened, and that was some bad football. That was some bad football, and I watched the Philadelphia Eagles, and that was a team that really, in terms of putting guys on putting a good product out there, they put a bad product out there. It wasn't good football. It was some bad football.
Well, but let's look at that for a second, Paul. I think it's an interesting point. I mean, if you're the NFL, I think history showed not only was that bad football, but in looking at what other leagues did, you know, they would probably be best served, you know, to bag it, to be upset about having to bag it, but keeping it bagged.
We have under a minute left in the show. We want to thank Lee Steinberg for coming on to the show. We also want to thank Ashley Walker from Basketball Wise, VH1's Basketball Wise for Jarrett's, each and every Sunday at 8 o'clock on VH1. We also want to thank Jarvis Green. Make sure you check Jarvis Green out, his many charitable works.
They also want to thank Darnarian McCants, who stopped by and talked about life after football. Again, you can listen to this show and other shows at blogtalkradio.com/PGAN. That's blogtalkradio.com/PGAN, where you can listen to this show and other shows. For Jeremy Yespe, this is Paul Gant. Have a nice day. Have a nice weekend. See you later. Bye. And
happy
sure
birthday, Jermaine.
Make sure you follow this show on Twitter at GoForItGant. See you later. Take care. Bye.